Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. It's the DSR Daily, in which we talk about what's going on in the world and what we think it may mean. I'm David Rothkopf, joined as ever by Chris Cotnor. How are you doing, Chris?
Doing well, thank you.
Excellent. And Riley Fessler. How are you doing, Riley?
Pretty good.
What's the lead story for you, Chris?
The Supreme Court is anticipated to make a crucial decision about Donald Trump's eligibility on ballots. And I'm sure everyone is anticipating this historical decision by the Supreme Court to essentially not allow Donald Trump on any ballots.
Yeah, that's it, Chris. That's so right. You've really nailed this one again.
Here's the thing. The headlines are hilarious. I mean, you could go to any news. Supreme Court's expected to make a crucial decision. Guess what, guys? The decision's made. Donald Trump will be on. Will be on as many fucking ballots as he wants to be.
Right. And the Supreme Court, it is so transparent. They obviously knew what this decision was. Everybody who watched the hearing knew that it was 8-1 or 9-0 against the Colorado decision to take him off the ballot. That was weeks ago. And they didn't announce it before the immunity decision. They announced it after. And the reason is simple. They didn't want it to look like they have their thumb on the scale with, a negative and then this other thing. They thought that this, positioning these two this way would somehow look a little better. And it doesn't, because the other one looks like they have their thumb on the scale and this looks like they have the thumb on the scale. And, you know, the Supreme Court is acting as kind of the judicial wing of the Republican Party. And, you know, it's sad. The reality is this. They may, what'll be interesting to watch is what they say about how you actually remove a president from the ballot. Because the 14th Amendment's pretty explicit. And the only thing they can do is say that having one state do this or the way Colorado did it is wrong. But the question is whether they will actually lay out a roadmap that then people can follow. My guess is they won't even get that far because they don't actually want people to follow the roadmap. But it'll be the big news story today, even though there are other bigger things happening in Washington today. Riley?
Well, the U.S. military, in collaboration with the Jordanian Air Forces, began a humanitarian aid airdrop over the Gaza Strip over the weekend. The first wave of airdrops delivered over 38,000 meals in an attempt to kind of start addressing the humanitarian crisis as the kind of ground efforts have run into difficulties, to say the least. As we know, and we've covered on this show, many international watchdogs have warned that almost the entire population of Gaza is in immediate threat of famine, as we talked about both on our daily and on the DSR mothership. And despite the higher costs and logistical challenges associated with airdrops, figure I saw said that it's 7 times as expensive as ground delivery. And then, of course, you have the logistical issue of trying to get people on the ground to receive it. You know, this was viewed by the administration as a necessary step, despite the challenges.
I would say it was a necessary gesture. It's certainly not a constructive step. The humanitarian situation on the ground is ghastly. People are eating weeds. People are drinking salt water because there's no water available. They're eating animal food. Children have started to die. A quarter of the population of Gaza, which is over 500,000 people, are at risk of famine. And when you put it in those terms, you know, 38,000 meals isn't much, and having people scrambling on the beach or into the water in order to pick up these meals isn't the right way to do it. The U.S. should be working with other nations to bring shiploads full of supplies up along the Gaza coast. The U.S. should be much tougher with the Israelis on allowing trucks in. We're sort of at the rate of 96 a day, which is far, far, far from what is necessary. And everybody ought to be focusing on this, you know, stop the fighting, stop the humanitarian catastrophe. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Chris?
Exactly. Vice President Kamala Harris made remarks or essentially emphasizing the dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the need to have aid flow into the country, and called for a ceasefire for at least 6 weeks. I kind of actually like the idea of Vice President Kamala Harris as kind of the face of this, because it needs a full-time focus. It needs, you know, this drumbeat, which, you know, I feel like we've been steadily beating for the past month, needs to be heard every single day. You cannot imagine, and we've had people on the show and describing what's been going on in the country. But these people, just as you just said, they're suffering immensely, and a ceasefire is the only way forward.
Absolutely right. The other day, USAID Director Samantha Power made a speech in the West Bank. She said she'd talked to many people. She's been in the humanitarian world for a long, long time. And she said, according to the people she's spoken to, this is one of the worst situations we've ever seen. It's one of the fastest onsets of famine conditions that we have ever seen. And it just, you know, it just needs to be addressed. And the vice president's speech was important. She was in, I think, Selma, Alabama, marking Bloody Sunday. But she made a speech in which she said there needs to be a ceasefire, and we've got to address this aid issue. It was the most out front statement the U.S. has made on this, although people have been working towards that ceasefire for some time. You may recall that in December, at the COP28 summit, she made a speech saying we need to focus on the day after and a two-state solution and the recovery of Gaza, which was, again, sort of leaning into this solution-oriented approach here. She has been a leading voice for this, privately inside the administration, publicly outside the administration. And I think it really demonstrates her role as a leader on critical foreign policy issues. Benny Gantz, who is the primary opposition to Netanyahu last time around, and who joined then the war cabinet, former commanding general of Israeli Defense Forces, announced the other day that he was going to Washington. Netanyahu said, like hell you are, I'm the prime minister and I haven't authorized this. Gantz went ahead. Now, some people think this is a little bit of political theater, that, you know, Netanyahu may not have opposed as vigorously as he did publicly. But in any event, Gantz was immediately granted by the White House with the ability to meet with Vice President Harris and with National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. And who knows, if President Biden's in the area. A lot of people expect he may actually have a brief meeting with him as well. This is important on several levels. One, Netanyahu wanted such a meeting and didn't get it at the White House because of problems he's had with the administration for a long time. Two, Gantz is sort of presenting himself as an alternative voice and person to speak with to Netanyahu at a moment where, because of the famine and other factors, frustration with Netanyahu is starting to grow again. There were tens of thousands of people demonstrating in Israel this weekend against Netanyahu's treatment of the hostage negotiations. Their hostage families feel he has not prioritized their needs adequately. But, as I was implying earlier, one of the things that's interesting about this is that this very high-level, very sensitive meeting is going to be with the vice president. So she has been playing a role in this thing that is much different from the public perception of her role, which is central, could not be a more important issue. And it'll be very interesting to watch how this unfolds. Okay, now go to France.
Yeah, so France is on the brink of becoming the only country in the world to explicitly enshrine the right to abortion in its constitution, which is a pretty significant step, but it's a little bit embarrassing for the U.S. because the catalyst for this was the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. And, you know, French officials have said as much. This was kind of a system shock to prompt them into this action. Both the lower house, National Assembly, and the Senate have already shown support for the amendment, voting on it. And this will now lead to a final combined vote of both houses where they are expected to easily secure the necessary 3/5 majority. And it just kind of goes to show the difference in opinion in France compared to the U.S. The move is largely supported by the French public. The number I saw was that 86% of the public supports enshrining the right to abortion, which is unimaginable in an American context. And abortion has been legalized since 1975. So just an effort to kind of safeguard this. And again, because in the U.S., what we thought was kind of a guaranteed right from that decision clearly was not. So they are making the effort to ensure that this cannot be undone.
Yeah, interesting story. You know, France is primarily a Catholic country. For a long time, that was seen as an obstacle to policies like this. Now, policies in a lot of these Catholic countries are far more progressive than they are here in the U.S. as evangelical Christians play a more dominant role in our policymaking. But, you know, clearly it is another example of France saying, we are not like the U.S. We are going in a different direction. And, you know, candidly, they deserve some respect for it. Chris?
The Kremlin has accused Western countries, in particular Germany, of direct involvement in the Ukraine conflict because they intercepted some intelligence that apparently had German military officers discussing using German-made missiles to attack specific targets in Ukraine. I think, as with everything that comes out of the Kremlin, this is a nothing but a lot of propaganda. You know, I think it's a stretch to go and say there's been direct Western involvement because they were going to use German-made missiles. Ukraine is using military weapons and supplies from a lot of different countries. Just a lot of nonsense coming out of the Kremlin as usual.
As usual. Riley?
Well, Iran had their parliamentary election, and I think the results will not really surprise anyone. Hardline politicians retained their dominance throughout the legislature. These were the first elections since 2022 with mass protests. And in this first round, 245 of the 290 seats have been decided, with hardliners securing approximately 200 of them. So it's not really a huge surprise. The election saw limited participation from reform-minded candidates, with many of who were just broadly barred from running, which kind of highlights the government's stringent control over candidates. But the low turnout could be a problem as the regime has kind of historically used high turnout as a kind of thin veil to legitimize their rule. And it seems like the turnout was especially low this time, as they have not even released those numbers. So again, not a huge surprise, but the especially low turnout, I think, is an interesting point to highlight.
Indeed, in other election news, Nikki Haley won a primary in the District of Columbia and got 19 votes. She lost three caucuses to Trump by pretty substantial margins. But, you know, there's something about her candidacy. It's not like she's going to win unless Trump bails out. But she is coalescing anti-Trump voters. And I think that's got a big significance for the upcoming election. Because if those people are anti-Trump, never Trump, or those people are anti-Trump, I'm not going to go out of my way to vote for Trump. It could really, really damage his chances as the GOP candidate. We should only hope so, because, you know, this weekend Trump was out on the campaign trail, confusing Biden with Obama, slurring his words, making crazy statements, displaying real signs of neurological deterioration. One last point on this that I would encourage everybody to go to is there's a story in Rolling Stone, came out yesterday, about drug use in the Trump White House. Because as many of you may know, the Ronnie Jackson, the crazy Trump doctor who's now in the Congress, turned the sort of White House pharmacy into a dispensary for all sorts of intense drugs, speed, opioids, fentanyl. And the story says that during Trump White House, it was very common to see people pop a Xanax or two with alcohol during the workday, because the stress of working with and for Trump was just so great. So, you know, if it seemed like they were all drunk, it's because they were all drunk and stoned. Anyway, it's a great story. You should definitely go and look at it. And we'll look at the Gantz trip, and we'll look at the Supreme Court decision, and we'll look at other developments right here on the DSR Daily tomorrow and each and every day. So join us again. Until then, thank you, Chris. Thank you, Riley. And have a great day, everybody.